You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This is an episode that originally aired on YouTube, so there used to be a visual element. There is not anymore. This is just for your listening pleasure. Maybe you're out walking the dog or driving the car where it's not so easy to watch the video version. This is why this audio version exists. If you like us doing this, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate it, and let's get into this episode.
The King of Jerusalem stood captive in front of the Sultan. Next to him, the Lord of Carrick bulked in the sweltering July heat. Earlier that day, a mighty Christian army had been utterly destroyed by the arrow of the Muslims as much as they were by the decaying rays of an eastern sun. The Sultan, renowned for his generosity and his kindness towards his enemies, presented the King of Jerusalem with a most precious gift, at least in that moment. A beating cup of ice-cold water covered in mountain snow. The king accepted the cup and drank from it, then offered it to the Lord of Carrick. The Sultan spoke to the king and said, "This damned man did not drink water with my permission. If it had been so, he would be safe." The Sultan of Egypt and Syria, first of the Ayyubids, victor of Jacob's Ford and Hattin, slowly rose, his hand firmly gripped on the hilt of his sword. His name was Yusuf ibn Ayyub, now immortal in history as Salah ad-Din, or Saladin, the righteous of the faith. Before he became Saladin, Yusuf ibn Ayyub was born in 1137 in the castle of Tikrit, north of Baghdad. His father, Ayyub, was a Kurdish soldier and administrator who was employed by the Seljuk Turks, as many Kurds were, for his superb cavalry skills. At the time, the Seljuks occupied most of modern-day Iraq, Iran, and parts of the Middle East. Their dominion had brought some cohesion to the Muslim communities after a period of disunity had contributed to their first defeat in the First Crusade of 1095 to 1099. When Yusuf was born, three Christian states were thriving in the Levant: the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the Principality of Antioch, and the County of Tripoli, no relation to the current Libyan capital. The Muslim states and religious sects had been mainly preoccupied with fighting amongst themselves rather than the invading Christians, but that was about to change. In 1146, Ayyub's boss died. His name was Zengi, and he was a Syrian-based regional governor for the Seljuks. It was Zengi's conquest of Edessa, a Crusader city-state, that had sparked the Second Crusade, a major Muslim victory. His son and successor, Nur ad-Din, had even higher ambitions. Why report to the Caliph in Baghdad when you can simply start your own dynasty? Nur ad-Din would become one of Yusuf's mentors, and later an adversary. Nur ad-Din was also one of the first Muslim rulers to give the jihad an intellectual and militaristic energy. In other words, he started to campaign for a united Muslim front to drive away the Christians, or Franks, from the Holy Land. Nur ad-Din occupied Damascus, making it the seat of his power. The great Syrian city became the capital of his new dynasty, the Zengids, as well as a center for religious studies and propaganda calling for jihad against the Franks. In his teens, Yusuf moved to Damascus as an assistant to his second mentor, his uncle Shirkur. Shirkur was a trusted general of Nur ad-Din, a born warrior, a tough guy with a voracious appetite, a huge belly, and a blind eye. It was in this environment that Yusuf spent his formative years learning the art of military and political leadership from his two mentors. In the early 1160s, Nur ad-Din and Shirkur turned their eyes, all three of them, to Egypt. This wealthy and fertile land was ruled by a Shia dynasty, the Fatimids, and their power was vacillating. It was a great opportunity for the rulers in Damascus to expand their territory and get a hold of Egyptian riches before the Franks in Jerusalem did the same thing. Shirkur was the right man for the job, and he delivered. With Saladin as a trusted second in command, the general took control of Egypt in the summer of 1169, becoming its minister on behalf of Nur ad-Din. Surely Shirkur had reasons to celebrate, but he probably partied a bit too much, because 2 months after the conquest, the voracious general died, apparently due to indigestion. This tragedy, it did have a silver lining for Yusuf, though. His uncle's death meant that he could succeed him as minister. On paper, he was likely to fail. He was an outsider, a Sunni Kurd at the service of a Sunni Turk, administering a land of Shia Arabs with no real bureaucratic experience to speak of. But in spite of all this, Saladin thrived in his new job. The key to Saladin's success was that he surrounded himself with the right people. He started appointing family members to key advisory positions or protection positions around him in order to make sure that he had an inner circle of loyal advisors. His own father even became the chief treasurer. But Saladin also appointed complete outsiders based on their own merits and regardless of their ethnicity or religious affiliation. With the help of his council, he succeeded in boosting Egypt's economy, increasing his personal power and his prestige. Slowly but surely, Saladin was following Nur ad-Din's example by founding his own dynasty, the Ayyubids. Nur ad-Din realized what was happening and summoned him repeatedly to Damascus. This is when Yusuf demonstrated yet another key talent: procrastination. Fearing some sort of punishment for his increasing independence from Damascus, Yusuf delayed meeting with his boss for as long as possible. By 1174, Nur ad-Din had had enough. He was going to travel to Egypt to meet his employee. Oh, and he would also bring an army on the side because, well, you never know how those end-of-year reviews might turn out. But Yusuf was not only a skilled man, he was also a lucky man. And just before the start of a new campaign, Nur ad-Din died of natural causes. Saladin, who had previously worked as the mere minister of Egypt, could suddenly seek a more prominent job title. Before the calendars could flip to 1175, Saladin had captured Damascus and was formally recognized by his nominal boss, the Caliph of Baghdad, as the Sultan of Egypt and Syria. In the late 1170s and early 1180s, Saladin expanded and consolidated his power by both military and diplomatic means. His Ayyubid dynasty became a reality. Saladin fought and defeated several rebellious local leaders who did not view him as Nur ad-Din's true successor, with the toughest cookie being Nur ad-Din's son. Saladin laid siege to Aleppo and defeated him in 1183. But that wasn't the end of it. If riches were measured in headaches and thorns in your side, Saladin may have been the wealthiest man in the world. As a Sunni leader, Saladin had to compete with the stubborn resistance from Shia factions in his new territories, which took the form of assassination attempts from, well, the assassins, or more correctly, the Fadan of the Nizari Shia sect. By the way, we also have a video about their founder, Hassan Sabah. You should check out that video as well, once you're done with this one, of course. Saladin also had to keep at bay the Seljuk Turks, his former overlords from whom he had broken away. In a diplomatic masterstroke, the Sultan signed a defensive treaty with the Byzantine Empire against the Turks, which allowed him to concentrate on other matters. One of these matters was finding a suitable wife, which is rarely a benign decision for a monarch. Yusuf married a noblewoman called Ismat, who happened to be Nur ad-Din's widow. I'm sure these two loved each other to bits, but it's undeniable that the match was extremely convenient for Saladin. Ismat was also the daughter of a previous governor of Damascus, so this move ensured that Saladin be associated with two ruling dynasties, enhancing his prestige. Saladin also had another matter pressing at him. What could be done about the Christian kingdoms? He had continued Nur ad-Din's efforts to rally the Sunni community around the common goal of chasing the Christians away from the Levant, especially from Jerusalem, one of the holiest cities in Muslim worship. Until this point, the idea of a holy war against the West had served as a handy prop to unify his dominions, and now it was time to deliver. Back in 1174, Jerusalem's king Amalric had died, and he was succeeded by his son, Baldwin IV. Baldwin was a frail, inexperienced teenager, sadly afflicted by leprosy. The boy became known as the Leper King, and his perceived lack of leadership led everybody in the Levant to underestimate him. By November 1177, Saladin thought the time was ripe to pluck Jerusalem from Baldwin's sickly hands. He assembled an army of 27,000 men and moved north from Egypt, confident in an easy victory. But Saladin had underestimated his enemy. Baldwin gave command of an army to French nobleman Reynald de Hatillon, an experienced military leader. Then the two led a small force to Ascalon, south of Jerusalem, to intercept Saladin's march. The Egyptian army encircled the Christians, but did not engage with them. Saladin gave orders instead to march further north and loot three villages before reaching Jerusalem. For a renowned general, Saladin had made two huge tactical mistakes. First, he had not engaged when he was in a position of strength. He had also allowed his larger army to disperse in enemy territory. Reynald and Baldwin, they escaped the encirclement and raced northwards. The Christians attacked at Montgazard near Ramla on the 25th of November. Saladin's numerical advantage had been neutralized, as much of his forces were still dispersed and his elite cavalry was exhausted from the long trek from Egypt. The Christian knights charged the center of Saladin's formation. They were spearheaded by 80 Templars, one of whom was the Bishop of Bethlehem, carrying a piece of the true cross. The victory was total. Saladin's center crumbled under the charge, while Renal's men seized the supply train of the Egyptians. Saladin himself narrowly escaped capture by riding on a racing camel. This defeat had taught a harsh lesson to the Sultan. Saladin would now focus on further strengthening his sultanate and his army before attempting conquest again. In the meantime, the Franks had grown in confidence, and Baldwin went on to provoke Saladin by building a castle at Jacob's Ford within reach of Damascus. From there, the Christian knights could easily launch raids against the Syrian capital. Saladin was fighting rebels in northern Syria and could not attack when the castle fortifications were still weak. He tried to bribe Baldwin, offering 100,000 dinars if he abandoned the construction project, but the teenage king refused the offer, and by April, his castle had opened for business. Now Saladin needed a victory to restore credibility after Montgisard. After quelling the rebellion in the north, he assembled his forces and launched a siege on August 24, 1178. Saladin knew that he had to act quickly. He had received news that Baldwin was leading a relief army towards the castle. The Sultan ordered for the walls to be targeted by a constant deluge of arrows to weaken the Frank garrison. At the same time, a contingent of expert Syrian miners had started to sap the walls of the northeastern corner. This concentrated action rapidly dug deep pits under the ramparts, which were then set on fire. The mighty 10-meter walls were weakened by the heat, and finally they collapsed. The Ibid army poured through the breach and massacred 800 of the defenders. Saladin also captured 700 prisoners and tons of loot, including 1,000 suits of armor. The castle had fallen after only 5 days. In 1180, Saladin and Baldwin IV agreed to a truce whereby the Crusader kingdoms and the Ayyubid territories would coexist in peace for 2 years. But that truce would never be carried out. Renald de Hattilien, Baldwin's European ally, ruled over two powerful strongholds, the Karak and Montreal, which gave him control over routes used by Muslim traders and pilgrims going to Mecca. In the summer of 1181, Hattilien plundered one of these caravans. Saladin asked for the loot to be returned, but the arrogant lord refused, causing hostilities to resume both on land and at sea. Renard launched a fleet of 5 galleys in the Red Sea, attacking merchant ships, raiding Muslim ports, and even threatening Mecca. Saladin's own Egyptian fleet destroyed the raiders, but the Sultan was not as successful on land. He attempted to seize the Karak twice in 1183 and 1184, and twice the leper king came to the rescue of Renard. The following year, though, the young, sickly king died childless, leaving his throne to his 8-year-old nephew, Baldwin V. The boy's tutor, the Count of Tripoli, negotiated another truce with Saladin. It was a wise move because the leadership in Jerusalem was about to become rather messy. 1 year later, in 1186, the boy king, Baldwin V, died, as did his father. The mother, Sibylla, remarried a French nobleman, a guy named, well, Guy of Lusignan. And here Hattilien enters the picture again, as he ensured that Guy be named King Regent of Jerusalem. Next, the untamable Renald did what he was best at, breaking truces and raiding Muslim caravans. But the one he plundered in 1186 was not just any caravan. According to some contemporary sources, Saladin's sister was traveling in it, although this claim is disputed. In any case, it was yet another provocation. King Guy asked Renal to return the loot and the prisoners to Saladin, but the stubborn lord refused. Up to that point, Saladin had taken advantage of the truces with the Christians to complete the conquest of Mosul, which is modern-day Iraq, from a rival Sunni leader. With Mosul under his control, the Sultan had completed the consolidation of his reign, enveloping Jerusalem, Tripoli, and Antioch. Now the Sultan was ready to launch an all-out attack on the Franks. He would not allow this last provocation to go unpunished. The Sultan of Egypt and Syria was ready for his greatest feat yet. It was time to reclaim Jerusalem. His eldest son, Al-Afdal, quickly recruited 24,000 troops, and in the summer of 1187, Saladin made his first move, the capture of Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. Guy of Lusignan did not respond to the provocation, but his counselors, including Hattilien and the Knights Templar, insisted that he act, lest he lose his fragile grip on the throne. So, at the behest of his European allies, Guy sent 1,300 knights and 18,000 soldiers on a trek of 32 kilometers from Jerusalem to Tiberias. This was an endless march under the ruthless July sun of the Levant across an arid plateau, with all water supplies cut from them by the Ayyubids. Guy had fallen into Saladin's trap. The journey to Tiberias was a living nightmare for the Franks. Saladin's mounted archers targeted them with a constant rain of arrows. According to contemporary writer Imad ad-Din, the arrows plunged into them, transforming their lions into hedgehogs. By the 3rd of July, the Frank army had set up a camp for the night near the village of Hat Inn and got some respite. But it was short-lived. On the morning of the 4th, Saladin had ordered his men to set fire to the surrounding grass and brush, choking the Christians and making their thirst even worse. As a further rain of arrows descended upon them, the Christian infantry scattered out of formation. The Templar and Hospital and Knights tried two consecutive desperate charges against the Ayyubid center in a repeat of Montgazard, but Saladin was ready and had his own riders encircle and massacre the Crusaders. By the end of the Battle of Hat Inn, the mighty Christian army had been crushed. Thousands lay dead, many more were captured and sold into slavery. The Templars and Knights Hospitallers, who had been so unlucky to fall prisoners to the Ayyubids, were beheaded one after the other in a relentless display of butchery. The holiest of the relics, the True Cross, had fallen into the Muslims' hands. It was after Hat Inn that Saladin met with the commanders of the Franks, Guy of Lusignan and the despised Rénal of Châtillon. Saladin offered a cup of icy water to Guy, who then passed it to Rénal. Saladin turned to the king and he spoke, "This damned man did not drink water with my permission. If it had been so, he would be safe." This was a clear threat. If the Sultan had offered the water directly to Rénal, the Lord of Carrack would have been under his protection, according to the customs of hospitality. But this was not the case. Saladin rose, unsheathed his sword, and with his own hand, he cut off Atelion's head. The Sultan then reassured Lusignan, "It is not the wont of kings to kill kings, but that man had transgressed all bounds." In an act of chivalric generosity, which many described as typical of the Sultan, Saladin freed Guy on one condition: to promise he would never again take up arms against the Muslims. The news of the defeat it soon reached Western Europe. The True Cross had been lost, the Frank army was decimated, and Jerusalem was now vulnerable. Saladin moved on to besiege the Holy City, defended by the French nobleman Balian of Ebelin. After Hat Inn, Balian had fled to Jerusalem to reunite with his wife. In order to cross the Ayyubid lines, he had promised to Saladin that he would not fight the Muslims anymore. As soon as he reached Jerusalem, Queen Sibylla asked him to lead the defense of the city, which he reluctantly agreed to. As Saladin's army approached Jerusalem, Balian sent him an envoy informing him of his decision. Since Hat Inn, Lusignan had already broken his promise, and now Balian? Well, the Sultan was furious. On September the 20th, 1187, the Egyptian and Syrian army camped in sight of the city walls. In spite of his anger, the Sultan tried to find a diplomatic resolution, but the talks were fruitless and a siege ensued. Throughout September, Balian was able to repel the Sultan's attempts to storm the city walls or tear them down with mangonels and catapults. It was only at the end of the month that Saladin applied his experience from Jacob's Fort. His sappers weakened a section of the walls near the Mount of Olives, which collapsed on the 29th of September. Even still, the Ayyubid army could not force their way through the breach, which allowed for further talks and a peaceful transition for the city. Balian negotiated for 7,000 citizens not to be sold into slavery against a ransom of 30,000 mizans. Saladin agreed, and in an act of generosity, later persuaded his officers to free, without ransom, most of their captives. The remaining Western inhabitants left Jerusalem, while the Eastern Christians were permitted to remain. Saladin had all churches converted into mosques, except for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. All Christian pilgrims would be granted safe passage from then on, a decision which should have prevented further conflicts with the European kingdoms. Saladin had won Jerusalem back for his kingdom, and he had done so with minimal Christian bloodshed. His conflict with the Europeans, it should have ended there. Unfortunately, his plan of peace didn't quite work. After hearing of the capture of Jerusalem, Pope Gregory III allegedly was so shocked that he died of a heart attack. He had just enough breath left in his lungs to call for a holy war. At the time of Saladin's Great Jerusalem Conquest, there were three great monarchs on the European continent. Frederick I of the Holy Roman Empire, known as Barbarossa, Philip II Augustus of France, and the English king Richard I, the Lionheart. All three rallied around the new Pope Clement III and raised a new collective crusader army. Together, they undertook the Third Crusade. On his way to the Holy Land, Barbarossa was stalled by the Byzantine Empire, still tied to Saladin by their previous alliance. Frederick pressed on, only to drown in a river in Cilicia on June 10, 1190. Ironically, he had taken the land route due to his fear of drowning in the sea. His army, the strongest of the Crusader forces, it was scattered and returned to Germany. Exactly 1 year later, Philip and Richard finally arrived in the Levant and took part in the major battle against Saladin's forces, the Siege of Acre, a major Ayyubid garrison. Thanks to Guy of Lusignan, the city had been since August of 1189, but he soon found himself surrounded by more Ayyubid troops, a siege within a siege. Richard the Lionheart soon proved to be a perfect match for Saladin's military skills. He could bring to the table a sound strategic mind, effective siege engines, and tons of cash. On his way to Acre, Richard had conquered Cyprus from the Byzantines and then sold it to the Templars. This sweet deal in real estate allowed him to pay for additional sappers that brought down Acre's walls. The city was captured on July the 12th alongside the bulk of Saladin's navy. Richard offered to return more than 2,000 prisoners to Saladin for a ransom, but the Sultan's drawn-out negotiations exasperated the English king, leading to their mass execution. Soon Philip II had to abandon the crusade to deal with threats to his throne back home. Richard was now numerically inferior against the Ayyubids, but his campaign would still benefit from a more unified leadership structure. On the other side of the battle, Saladin seemed to have lost his touch. Maybe the Sultan and general, as well as his armies, were simply exhausted after years of incessant campaigning against Christian kingdoms and Muslim rebels. It has been speculated that Saladin had been ill for several years as he began to show symptoms comparable to those of irritable bowel syndrome. Whatever the reasons for this decline, he could not stop the march of the Crusader king from Acre down to Jerusalem. Saladin tried to replicate the success of Hattin, first by harassing Richard's column with hordes of mounted archers, then by engaging in a pitched battle at Arsuf on September 7, 1191. But Richard was not Lusignan. He had ensured one flank of his army was protected by the coastline, avoiding encirclements, and he understood the concept of logistics, meaning his soldiers were unlikely to die of thirst. Saladin did not suffer heavy losses, but the stalemate forced him to withdraw. Richard's army then took Jaffa, where they rested until January 1192. The Lionheart was within reach of Jerusalem by now, but he hesitated to attack. He believed he could take the city, but he was certain his army could not sustain a counterattack. The Crusaders basically did nothing for 6 months, as did Saladin, another sign of his waning decisiveness. Only in July did Saladin reconquer Jaffa, but lost it again to the Lionheart in August. This would be the last time the two leaders would face each other in battle. When I say face each other, I don't mean literally. A number of legends and popular novels depicted Saladin and Richard as best frenemies who remained respectful of each other while engaging in battles and even personal duels. In fact, though, the two never met in person. Even after Jaffa, when the two sides engaged in lengthy negotiations, these were always carried out by envoys. Richard did develop a liking for Saladin at a distance, and it is mainly thanks to him that Europeans learned to appreciate the Sultan as a fair ruler and combatant, embodying the ideals of perfect chivalry. Richard even considered having his sister Joanna engaged to Saladin's brother. The results of the negotiations were not a marriage, but a peace deal that was agreeable to both sides. Richard had fallen ill and was itching to return to England, where his brother John was conspiring with Philip of France to strip him of his lands. Saladin was only too eager to get rid of the Lionheart and gave important concessions. The Crusaders would retain a strip of land around Acre, and he would ensure safe passage for all Christian pilgrims going to Jerusalem. In their last exchange of letters, Richard wrote to Saladin that sooner or later he would return and conquer the Holy Land for good. The Sultan replied, accepting the challenge and writing that if he had to lose his empire to another king, he could not think of a better one. The Third Crusade was over by October 1192. Richard had scored a number of tactical victories, but in the end, Saladin had the upper hand, strategically speaking. His sultanate was still intact. Would Saladin have ever expanded his territories beyond their boundaries at the end of the Third Crusade? We don't know, as Yusuf ibn Ayyub died 5 months later, on the 4th of March 1193. Maybe it was irritable bowel syndrome, or perhaps it was just sheer exhaustion from constant warfare. The coalition he had built quickly disintegrated, as three of Saladin's sons took control of Egypt, Damascus, and Aleppo. Other relatives and subordinates squabbled for the remainders. The Ayyubid dynasty ruled until 1260, when it was overthrown by an emerging power in Egypt, the Mamluks. Despite spending much of his time fighting fellow Muslims instead of Christians, Saladin is remembered in modern times as the great adversary of the Crusaders. He was a valiant, fair, and generous military leader, one who did not shy away from bloodshed or even prisoner execution, but one whose conduct in Jerusalem was nonetheless exemplary. In spite of the occasional tactical blunder, Saladin eventually achieved all of his strategic goals. His empire may have crumbled in a span of a few decades, but this may have ultimately been his life's major achievement, to be remembered as a hero, both by Islam and Christianity.
So I really hope you enjoyed that one. As I said at the beginning, it'd be great if you left us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. That would be cool. Maybe you're driving right now. Just remember to do that when you get home. That would be really cool of you. If you want to say hi to me on social media, I'm at Simon Whistler. That's just at Simon Whistler, no dot or anything in there, on Twitter and Instagram and, you know, maybe some other places in the future. That depends on when you're listening to this, but it'll always be at Simon Whistler. So go check that out. And as always, I'll see you next time.